one of the hardest things to do is to separate your work from and what your effort that you put in from the results that might come out of it. So it's like, think about it. It's like an actor doesn't control the movie around them. They don't control what the other actors do. They don't control the marketing budget. They don't control the distribution. So, you know, they could do the role of a lifetime, but then the director could, or the editor could mess it up in post-production. Right. And so if your happiness with your job and your career is dependent on how the movie does at the box office or how the critics respond to your role, you have now placed your happiness with your own life in the hands of other people. And that's a recipe for profound disappointment.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. So we're right around the corner from the launch of our new book, Unmistakable: Why Only Is Better Than Best. And if you haven't done it yet, you can actually download the introduction for free at unmistakablecreative.com/book. And if you want to get access to all the pre-launch emails and all the pre-launch content, sign up for the Quiver at unmistakablecreative.com/newsletter. And if you have aspirations yourself to do something like write a book, the easiest way to get started, believe it or not, is with a blog and a website. Seth Godin recently said in an interview, the best way to be where you want to be a year from now and 10 years from now is to do something today you'll be glad you did. And today's sponsor, HostGator, can help you to get started with 30% off all their hosting packages, super reliable support, and an easy-to-use website builder. So visit HostGator.com/creative and use a promo code creative at checkout for 30% off. Ryan, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
It's amazing to be here. You were one of the first podcasts I ever did, and so it's I feel like it's coming full circle talking again.
Well, it's really cool to have you back here. I mean, you know, for people who are listening, this is the third time we've actually had you on the show, and you're one of the few people that has made it back for a third appearance, which really, I think, says a lot about the body of work that you've created. I mean, you introduced me to my literary agent, so I have a lot of gratitude for the work that you do. But I want to start today's conversation a little bit differently than we have in the past, because I think a lot of people know about your story. They know a lot about your work. And this actually came from Brian. He said, ask Ryan about this. So I want to ask you what social group you are a part of in high school and how that has ended up impacting your life and the work that you've ended up doing.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think some people have a very clear idea, like this is my group. I was a jock or, mm-hmm. I was like a loser. I think I was sort of in between, although I mean maybe someone could make a case that I was a loser and I just wasn't aware of it. So I ran cross country and track for 4 years of high school, and track and cross country are a strange thing because it's an athletic endeavor, but it's a totally a solitary one. Uh-huh. And then it tends to attract the people that couldn't cut it in any of the other sports. So like I was okay. But when I look back, for instance, when I look back on my like athletic career as a high schooler, I see like a ton of wasted potential. I remember I would get in trouble all the time. I never took it seriously. I feel like I was stuck in this space where I was afraid that if I tried really hard, I think subconsciously, I don't think this is conscious. I think I was in a world where I was pretty good naturally. And so that was enough. Like I was confident in that natural ability, but I didn't try very hard because then if I tried really hard, it would be on me. The success or failure would be on me. And so I sort of took this lackadaisical, ironic, very immature attitude about all of it. And I think most of my friends did too. So it was this, now I love running and I run every single day and it's something I take a lot of pride in, the sort of the routine and the dedication of it. But when I look back at my high school career, that sort of thread runs through all of it. Like in classes where the teacher liked me, I worked really hard. In ones where I felt like the teacher wasn't treating me fairly or didn't like me, I didn't try hard at all. And so I sort of see that pattern of I was in the group of the people who didn't value their time or their effort or their identity very highly. I think I preferred to be ironic about it all, probably because I was afraid. Mm.
What's the most important thing that you learned from a coach when running track that you've incorporated into your life today?
Yeah, it's funny. My coaches and I, we really didn't get along. I think I got kicked off the team at some point in every single one of the 4 years for some infraction. But I remember I had this one coach, her name was Miss Simpson, and she was giving us this advice one time. So in cross country, obviously the track is hilly, and what you'll notice is that that people run really hard on the downhill part because all of a sudden you feel like you're going really fast. And I remember what she would yell at us all the time was this idea of like, actually you should pass people on the uphill. And if you've done your conditioning, you can pass people on the uphill. And then on the downhill, if you understand form correctly, the downhill should not be where you speed up. The downhill should be where you're making gravity work for you. And so that's something I sort of use that as a metaphor, or I guess an analogy. Sometimes it's this idea of like, okay, it's on the uphill when other people are struggling that your conditioning really kicks in. And it's on the downhill where you get the illusion of progress, where people think like, oh, I'm passing all these people because I'm going really fast. But if you're doing it right, that should actually be where you're conserving a lot of your energy. So even as a runner, I think about that now. I really like hills. I sort of look forward to them. But then in life, I think it's in the difficult scenarios when you're overloaded with stress or when things are going difficult. That's where I feel like I'm making my progress or I'm going to make my move. And then it's when things are going awesome that's when the discipline and and your understanding of the form really makes the biggest difference. And you've got to be willing to put your ego aside a little bit and be okay with the difference between perception and reality there.
Yeah, we'll actually talk about that in depth. It's funny because it makes me think of something I wrote recently, also based on a conversation I had with Brian. You know, we were talking about sort of the momentum that we're gathering as we're going into a launch of a book. And I said, so what do you know, what comes after this? And he said, all I can tell you is don't stop doing what got you there in the first place.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, I think with running, what you're thinking about is one of the things I'm always thinking about with running is like you have to keep your own pace and your own sort of game plan. And if you're not, then you can get really distracted by what other people are doing or what you're suddenly supposed to do in a given situation. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, hey, if I'm waiting to the last mile to start my kick, just because somebody else starts it at a mile and a half doesn't mean that I match them step for step, or I'm not going to have any gas left when I need it. And so that's something I'm thinking about too, is like, no, I'm running a race with myself. Mm-hmm. I know what sort of pace I can hold. I know what I need to do. And you've got to sort of cultivate kind of an indifference to what's going on around you, or you can end up burning yourself out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I love that because it sounds like it's about a lot more than running. I mean, we live in a world where we can constantly look at what everybody else is doing.
Yeah, of course. Not only can you, you know, you're supposed to log into Facebook every day and it's a parade of everyone else's accomplishments, or, you know, you pull up Instagram and it's a parade of what they want you to think their lives look like, you know, through these manipulative filters and such. And so you've got to know like, hey, this is what's important to me. This is what I value. These are the benchmarks that I'm measuring myself against. And it's really a recipe for not just madness to follow all these other people, but, you know, deep unhappiness.
Yeah. Yeah. Without a doubt. We'll start talking about a lot of this and quite a bit more depth when we actually start talking about the book. I want to ask you one other question about, you know, the cross country period. I'm curious what you learned about habits and discipline that you brought from that you bring into the work that you do today.
So, I mean, I would say I learned all the lessons of what you're not supposed to do, right? Because I wasn't doing it. I remember in track, I ran a 5:02 mile when I was, I don't know, a sophomore or a junior in high school, which is pretty good. And I remember passing the finish line. I see 5:02. I've been shooting for 5 minutes. Like, I wanted to break five. That was like my goal. And I remember thinking like, oh, 5:02, like that's good enough. You know, that was my teenage response to failure, not like a catastrophic failure, but a disappointment, right? It's like, oh, it's good enough. And I had no idea that that's like not a good enough attitude, that 2 seconds doesn't seem like a big deal, but it is a big deal, and that you make progress in your life holding yourself to those standards. And so it wasn't until I was maybe like 22 or 23, so years later, that I was like, no, that matters to me. Like, I did all that work to get to almost to five, and then I stopped. And so I set a goal. I ended up doing like 4:55, but it took like a year or so of training to be able to get there. And so it's like, you know, getting close and then calling it close enough is not, I wish a coach had been like, great job, but not good enough, you know, instead of patting me on the back and congratulating me. I wish he'd held me to a higher standard, and I wish I could have held myself to a higher standard. But I didn't have that then. It wasn't until college. You know, one day I just started running, and I've run almost every single day since then. And the idea that, you know, it's holding yourself to a routine or to a standard that matters, and that it's the doing the thing every single day that's the real marathon, right? It's not, hey, I ran a race and I did okay, and this is a fun hobby. It's like, no, this is an activity that I'm dedicated to, and I get better by committing to the craft and, you know, sort of doing it every single day.
Yeah. I mean, that's been me and my 1,000 words a day. I haven't stopped doing it for probably 4 years at this point, maybe more.
Yeah, no. And so, someone might write 10,000 words in 2 days, and that's really impressive. But, you know, it's the fact that Jerry Seinfeld has that thing. It's like, yeah, your job is not to break the momentum, you know, or not to break the line of X's on the calendar. And how long can you go? And the more that you can, the better you get. And I think people, because they just see the results, like they just see the one article, and they're like, I liked that article, but I didn't like this article. And they don't understand that it's the aggregate output that you care about. Obviously, you care about each individual article, but
right.
It's really the fact that after however many days, you're going to have written 1,000,000 words. Mm-hmm. And what is the aggregate quality of those 1,000,000 words? I think that's what I care about. And that's what I'm working on. You have to be able to develop that. And I think it's really hard when you're 16 years old to realize that 10 years from now, you're going to care about this streak. Yeah. And that if you'd started it now, you'd be even prouder of it.
Why do you think that people have such a hard time with committing to a standard and they settle so often for good enough?
I think fear is a large part of it, right? Like if you don't care, then you don't have to feel bad about yourself, right? You don't, like, it's hard to write an article and it not be good enough, right? That's an unpleasant feeling. It's hard to publish an article and have someone say that they don't like it. Those things are tough. So I think that's a big part of it. And then I think a huge part of it is ignorance, right? So you don't, like for instance, like dieting, right? Like eating well. When you're not eating well, you think that you like how you're eating, right? Like you're like, I got pizza when I want it, and I got candy when I want it, and I drink soda, and I enjoy the pleasure of those indulgences. And dieting is an unpleasant period where you're depriving yourself of things and you're not enjoying what you're eating. And so on the other side of that is what health feels like, which is, you know, not only the absence of all the crappiness that you feel, but it's you know, good, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think people don't understand that what's on the other side is actually better. And so they're not willing to endure the short-term crappiness to get to the other side. And that's the paradox, right? It's like, yeah, you have to have faith that, hey, so-and-so is telling me if I cut these things out of my life will be better, but it's going to be unpleasant to do so. You have to have the faith that, and listen and be able to take a risk.
Well, I think that makes a perfect transition to talk about something that I know both of us are deeply passionate about, which is this whole idea of deep work, which you know, you and I have both written plenty about in our recent articles. And so I want to talk about your entire creative process, productivity systems that you have in place. I know you're a voracious reader and you know people have always wondered how you do all of these things. So I wanted to spend a little time this time talking about systems that you've put in place, habits that you've put in place that facilitate this creative process, and also talk about the research process that goes into your books, because it's one of the things I've always enjoyed about reading your work is that even though I can't get myself to read a history book, I get history lessons from reading your books. And that's one thing I've really appreciated. So I'd love to talk about all of this in a bit more detail and find out, you know, how this all comes together.
Yeah. So, I mean, I do think deep work is very important. I think people don't understand that a book is not, hey, I have an idea for a book and then I wrote it, right? It's hundreds of hours of research. It's finding little nuggets all over the place and going, hey, I like that line. I'm going to write that down. And then thinking on it and putting it away and storing it. You know, I think I've been meaning to put something together. I was thinking about my last book. I know exactly what book I was reading. And I mean, it's easy to find what page it was in that book that I found the sort of the crux of what became The Obstacle is the Way. It was a book by Pierre Hadot. He's talking about this exercise called turning obstacles upside down, which is in, you know, the Meditations of Marcus Aurelius. I remember finding that and writing it down on a note card. It wouldn't have been for 4 years that I started writing that book, maybe more, right? And I'd been introduced to meditations even before that. So people don't understand that writing a book is that process. It's the nugget of the idea and then the accumulation of time and thinking. And all of that is in the quiet, deep work where you're sitting alone, thinking and working or researching. And so a book might take 10 hours to read, in actual reading time, but it might be the accumulation of thousands of hours of work.
Yeah.
And I try to carve out as much of you have to carve out that time from somewhere. It doesn't happen in a sprint 2 weeks before the book is due, right?
Right.
It's every day putting in 3 or 4 hours for a year in a row that gets you maybe your crappy first draft.
Yeah. I would agree with that, having just gone through the process.
Yeah. And then, then the next part of the process is the editing and the rewriting and all that, which is, you know, hey, this is the fourth time I've worked on this paragraph, tweaking these, you know, these words about, because so-and-so said it was too much like this.
Yeah.
And then somebody else said it was too much like that, you know? And so people don't, I think, you know, we live in this world now where people think like a book is something you hire someone to make for you, or, you know, maybe there's a software that can do it for you or whatever. They don't really understand that the difference between a book that lasts and a book that might get, sell 1,000 copies on Amazon or whatever is those hundreds and hundreds of hours.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I've been curious about, I've been like borrowing a lot of ideas from your process lately. Like I tend to read primarily physical books. I underline lots of passages and I find that I frequently return to books that I've already read.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that actually has been really informative in coming up with ideas. Cause sometimes I'll just open a book and look at what it is that I've underlined in the morning. And that'll be my inspiration for writing. Like I'll just grab one of the quotes that I underlined and that's how I'll start my 1,000 words. I'm curious, when you read a book, what is the process of absorbing the information in the book look like for you? Like what is, you know, do you underline stuff? I know you mentioned the note card system. So I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that, because I feel like we're in this really interesting sort of phase where we can consume content really fast. Like you can listen to an audiobook on 2X. You can fly through a book, you know, in an hour if you really don't read it closely. And so I'm really curious, you know, what your process for reading looks like so that you actually end up absorbing all this material.
Yeah, I mean, so I have on my desk right now a copy of Pat Conroy's The Great Santini, which I'd never read, which is a novel, and I read it maybe 2 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a fictional sort of coming of age tale, right? And I'm trying to look here. I've got I don't know, maybe 25 different pages that I folded, and then I read it. I had a pencil. I guess I couldn't find a pen. I had a pencil while I was reading it, and I mark certain passages that I like, or sometimes I didn't have the pencil, so I'm just marking the page. And then this is on my desk because today I'm gonna hopefully have 30 minutes to go through the book. I'm gonna write down all those passages that I liked, or you know, words that I needed to look up, or you know. In this one, I don't think he recommends any other books, but there might have been an afterword from the author where he's talking about other stuff. So I'm writing this down and I'm transferring them to 4x6 note cards. So next to it, I've got I think 100 packs of 4x6 index cards. And so I transfer, I read the book, I'm marking things that I think are of value to me either as a writer or as a human being. And then then I give it about 2 weeks to sort of sit. And then I'm transferring this knowledge to note cards. And this is a process I learned from Robert Greene, who I was a research assistant for all of his books. So like the 48 Laws of Power is comprised of, you know, like probably 5,000 note cards, or, you know, it's such a meticulously researched book. It's insane. But then I take those note cards and I organize them by theme. So like I was telling you that story about the obstacles away. I read that thing about turning obstacles upside down. I made a note card out of it. I put it in my box where I store them. And 4 or 5 years later, that became a book called The Obstacle is the Way, which is, you know, knocking on the door of having sold 200,000 copies. So you never know what this random passage or, you know, little nugget of information can turn into. And the reality is the vast majority of it turns into nothing. Mm. I go through my note cards right now and I'm like, what is this? Like, I don't like this. I don't agree with this. Or I can't even read my writing here. But, you know, the 1 in 100 times that it becomes something is enough to build a career around.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you actually review your note cards on a regular basis?
So obviously when I'm writing a book, I definitely, like, I'm having to go through, like, I had a huge section on stoicism in my general sort of box. And so when I'm writing a book about stoicism, I'm going through there and taking everything that fits with the thesis of that book. When I'm writing articles, I'm like, let's say like this week, I want to write an article about writing. I know that I do. And it's on my to-do list. I have a section of note cards about writing, and I'll take out those 200 or 300 note cards and I'll find a quote or an example or, you know, something, some thought that I've jotted down. And the vast majority of the piece isn't written, but the crux of the argument I've probably already discovered. And that's how I'm comfortable, you know, being able to say like, hey, write an article about this week, mm-hmm. because I've already kind of pre-researched it.
This episode of the podcast is sponsored by SaneBook. So how many emails do you have in your inbox right now? It could be 100, it could be 1,000, it could be 20,000. If your email is anything like mine used to be, the answer is probably too many and you might be suffering from email overload. But here's the thing, even though I wanted to do something about it, I didn't quite know how. I knew I'd be missing something important if I just deleted them all, and there are way too many emails to go through one at a time. And then I finally learned the secret to reaching inbox zero and taking back my email sanity, and it's called SaneBox, and I can't recommend it enough. SaneBox sorts through your email and moves all sorts of the trivial stuff into a different folder, so the only messages in your inbox are the ones that you actually want to see. And aside from removing all of the junk so you can focus on messages that matter, there's this great feature called a black hole. So if you move an email into that folder, you'll never hear from that sender again, meaning if there's somebody you get a lot of emails from that you don't want to get emails from, or somebody who's bothering you online, you can just put them in the black hole and that will be the end of your dealing with them ever. And since we could all use a bit more organization in our email life and be a bit more productive and more focused, we've actually worked out a great deal for our listeners with SaneBox. Just visit sanebox.com/creative today and they'll throw in an extra $25 credit on top of the 2-free week trial. And you don't even have to enter your credit card information unless you decide to buy. So there's really nothing to lose. So check it out and let us know what you think about the black hole as well as reaching inbox zero. I think you'll find it as rewarding as we do. Again, that's sanebox.com/creative. This episode is also sponsored by Design Crowd. So I've told you before that design is the first impression that you make on anybody who comes to your website. Yeah, they say maybe we don't judge a book by its cover, but we really do. And it's something you'll learn as you start to design more and more things. But often why people skimp on design is because they think that it has to be really inexpensive or that they don't know how to design. But with a service like DesignCrowd, you don't have to skimp on design because they make the equivalent of an entire creative team accessible to you at a price that's affordable to anyone. And here's how it works. You basically submit whatever your project might be. It could be flyers, brochures, book cover ideas, t-shirt designs, business cards, whatever you're looking for, even logos. And then you submit it to the crowd and you'll get anywhere between 60 to 100 submissions for your project. If you like one of the submissions, then you can approve payment. If you don't like what you get, you can actually go back to the crowd and ask for more or ask for your money back. And because you're an unmistakable creative listener, they're offering a special promotion where you get $100 off your first design project. So there's really no reason not to try it. All you have to do is visit designcrowd.com/creative and use the promo code creative for $100 off your first project. Awesome. Well, that was super helpful and insightful. So let's actually get into what we really want to spend the bulk of our time talking about today, which is this new book, Ego is the Enemy. So what I want you to talk about first is what the impetus was and how you sort of arrived at this conclusion.
So I wrote Obstacle in 2013. It came out in 2014, but I'm sort of in the space where you are, where the book was done and it wasn't out yet. And I always want to be thinking about the next project. And so I get a lot of emails from young people, and most of the emails are like insane, basically. Like, they're like, you know, I need you to do this for me, or like, why don't I have this? You know, they're just very entitled. And so I just knew I wanted to write something about that. And originally the book was going to be about humility. That's what I wrote the proposal about. It was sort of about humility and groundedness I get this sense that with social media, it's really easy to sort of, get high on your own supply. Right. Yeah. And so I wanted to write about that. And that's what I sold the proposal about. And, you know, then you sell the proposal and then you're just sort of researching and thinking. And when it started to come closer to like, okay, I have to write this, I just realized that like I'd read all these books about humility and there wasn't what I wanted. It wasn't working. And I realized that it's like writing a book about humility is like everyone knows humility is good and it's really hard to know whether you're doing it or not. And so it just wasn't making for the material wasn't supporting the hypothesis that I had, about, you know, this being a good book idea. And so thinking more about it and talking to me, I realized it was like, what I realized is that ego was really the problem. Everyone wants to be humble, but why can't they? It's ego is the problem. And as I flesh this out, it's like ego is the enemy of all these things that we're trying to do, whether it's write a book or start a company or, you know, be successful inside a company or have relationships. Ego is why these overconfident, you know, 17-year-olds are sending me these crazy emails, right? And so that was the hard part of the book. It's of writing the book is really figuring out what the hell it's going to be. And once I had that, then it came together really quickly. I started to get the structure. I started to get the stories that I wanted. And I just realized that I realized how it connects to Obstacle is that, you know, Obstacle is about these external things that we face.
Yeah.
And ego is our biggest internal obstacle. And it makes like all the things that I was talking about in terms of the Stoic mindset, ego makes impossible, right? You know, the reason someone tries something and then fails and then goes, oh, I can't do it, it's impossible. The reason they think that is because they've brought to it this idea that like, oh, if it doesn't come easy to me, it must be impossible because obviously I'm a genius and like everything I try is golden, right? It takes some humility to go like, hey, I don't know how to do this, but I'm going to figure it out. I'm going to stay at it. I'm going to hammer away at this thing. So it was only in the, one of my points is, you know, you think you sit down and you think you're going to do one thing, but you've got to be open to what the material is actually telling you. Mm-hmm. And then two, I just realized how much we get in our own way. And I saw, you know, I saw American Apparel collapse over, you know, the time that I was kicking this book around. And so that obviously influenced what I was talking about and thinking about. And I just came up with this idea of like, you know, ego is what stands between us and not just what we want to accomplish, but it stands between us and being satisfied or content with our accomplishments as well. Hmm.
So you mentioned that you get a lot of emails from young people, and I wanted to ask you about this because I know you specifically wrote about this. I mean, you in a lot of ways are an example for a lot of these young people because you've got to experience success at such a young age that the average person really doesn't. And so I'm curious how that early exposure to success influenced your own relationship with ego and really influenced your perspective on writing this book.
Yeah, I mean, so I was just very conscious. I started sort of meeting famous, important, successful people at like 18 or 19 years old, and I was working with them, and like I wasn't an equal, but I was like in the room, right? And so I was really, maybe I'm shy, I don't know what was motivating it, but I was really, really nervous about sort of being identified as like the young up-and-comer. I just wanted to be considered good, period, right? And so I kept seeing other people who were similar to me do well at first and then fall off. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to be different. I wanted to do this forever. And so that was one of the things I was always really scared about and I was thinking about and I would ask questions about. It's like, why do people sort of burn fast and bright and then go out? Yeah. Or, you know, why do people seem to implode their own careers? And so that was something I was really conscious of. And then the other thing is I just realized, like, I realized how precarious it was. Like, how it was like, I'm working for these people because they see something in me and they want, you know, they want me to be successful. But I also could see, like, it's like, hey, if I was an asshole, like, one day, or, like, if I suddenly thought I knew more than them on one day, I could blow this whole thing up. You know, like, I could, it took, you know, one petulant tantrum by me to undo everything I was doing. And so I guess I just had to be really conscious of it. And I thought about it all the time. That, so when I get these emails, I'm like, what is this? Like, why are you behaving this way? I'm like, sort of like appalled by it because I would never let myself act that way. You know, I get these emails and they're like, I would like you to be my mentor. What I would like is one phone call every single week for an hour where we review what I'm going on. And in exchange, I'm willing to give you X, Y, and Z. And I was like, you know, when I was working for Robert Greene, sometimes we'd go like 2 months without talking. Like I wasn't dictating terms to this person. I was just happy for whatever he would sort of throw my way. And I was, you know, working on my own project sort of quietly in the corner. So I think I am sensitive to it because I still can remember what that was like and how, what a tightrope it was.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get into a lot of the principles from the book because there were so many that really blew me away. Do you think you could give us sort of an overview of how ego plays the role that it does in our lives? And of course, more importantly, how to not let it destroy what we're capable of?
So yeah, obviously. I think the premise of the book is basically that each person exists at any time at sort of one of three different phases. You're either aspiring to do something, you've succeeded at something, or you're experiencing some sort of difficulty or failure. And my premise is that ego is the absolute worst ingredient to add into that one could find, right? So when you're trying to do something, you know, being delusional or being overconfident or, you know, being in ill-disciplined, you know, that's ego in the aspirational phase, and it prevents you from learning, prevents you from building relationships. You know, it puts you in a dangerous position. And then when you're successful, you know, ego manifests itself as control or delusion or entitlement. It also manifests itself in our complacency. We stop learning. We stop sort of holding ourselves to standards that were once important. And then finally, when we're going through adversity, the problem with ego is it prevents us from learning from our mistakes. It blames other people. It, you know, it tells us that this isn't worth it. It makes us hate, you know. So in basically in every phase of the creative process, every phase of the entrepreneurial process, every phase of life, basically, ego is this toxic ingredient that can seep in if we're not on guard against it. And so I wanted to look at the ways that that happened and then what we can do to prevent it, right? So yeah. Somebody who never stops being a student is inherently less likely to be egotistical because they've opened themselves up to learning and to education. They know that they're not ready yet. Even if they're doing this thing at a high level, they know there's always more they can be doing, always more than they could be learning. So, like, for instance, that mentality is inherently an antidote against ego. It's why, like in MMA, you meet these fighters who you'd think would be these intimidating, you know, arrogant figures, but in fact they're totally humble because they've dedicated themselves to this craft that there's never a graduation from.
You know, it's interesting when I hear you say that and really dissect it. I feel like we're constantly going through all those three phases throughout our lives. Like, it's not just you move from one to the other and that you're just there. Like, you don't go from aspiring to success and stay there. It seems like you have to constantly remember the lessons of each phase because you keep going through them consistently.
Yeah, of course, right? So you're aspiring to do something and then you succeed at it.
Yeah.
What's next is either you fail. I did probably because, like, you know, you made some mistake, you know, ego-driven mistake, or now you're aspiring to do something else, right? Yeah. Like, nobody's like, hey, you know, it's like, hey, I want to be a Major League Baseball player. Then, you know, you make the league. Well, now it's like, hey, I want to be, you know, the best at this position there ever was, or I want to win a championship, or, you know, I want to get into broadcasting, right? There's all these number of things that you want to do next. And ego is what prevents us from, you know, ego is what drives us to say, hey, I'm good at this thing. I must be good at everything else I want to do. And it ignores the fact that, hey, the reason I got good at this is because I was open to learning and I was open to feedback and I was willing to submit, you know, sacrifice short-term pleasure for long-term gains. You know, that's where ego prevents us. It's when you see, you know, somebody, their first company was really successful and then their second company, they lose everything because they, you know, they lost sight of why they were successful in the first place.
Yeah. You know, one of the pieces that really stayed with me from the aspiration page was the Bo Jackson story that you told. And I wanted to actually ask you about that and have you tell people about that, because I thought that was such a profound insight. And I'm like, wow, I'm like, that will be the last time I share most of my goals with the exception of like one or two people.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I think one of what I was talking about in the book is when Bo Jackson decided that he wanted to be number one in the, number one in the NFL draft, and I think he wanted to win the Heisman Trophy. Those were his like two goals. Mm-hmm. He didn't tell anyone. He just worked on them. I think he told his girlfriend. Those were the only two people that he mentioned. And you know, we live in this world where you could say, "Hey, I'm writing a book," and you post it on social media, and everyone's like, "Congratulations, you're an author."
Yeah.
You know, and so it's like you've gotten all the credit for this thing, but you haven't done it yet. And that's the reality is writing a book is really demoralizing. And so it's like, if you've already gotten the credit, you can quit. And so when we live in a world that encourages us to talk about what we're doing, because that's what fuels these social networks, but that can have a demotivating effect. Like, one of my favorite social media accounts is, I'm working on my novel, and it's basically like tweets of people talking about how they're working on their novel. And it's obviously they're not working on their novel, or they wouldn't have sent out that message on Twitter, right?
Right. So
it's the seduction of talk makes it possible, is in many ways like a sort of succumbing to the resistance that Stephen Pressfield calls the resistance. The more you're talking about the thing, the more public you are with your goal, the easier it's going to be for you to write it off when it gets hard, in my experience. And so I try to be really private with my goals. I don't talk about a book until it's done for the, you know, not out, obviously,
right,
but until it's like mostly written. You know, if I was starting a company, I wouldn't say, hey, I'm starting a company. I'd wait until I'd raised money for it, or, you know, I'd done a minimum viable product. Like, it's this idea that, like, hey, don't go around getting congratulations in advance for something or hyping yourself up. You're better off putting all of that energy into making the thing that you have to make, because that's what ultimately separates you from everyone else. Yeah.
So what did you learn about ego and your own sort of like working life based on the downfalls of the people you've seen? Because I know at the end of the book, you talk about Dov Charney, who I know played an incredibly influential role in you getting to where you're at today.
Yeah. I mean, when you watch, you know, one of your mentors, Dov, he was the founder of American Apparel. You know, I went to work for him 7 or 8 years ago, and, you know, he had a $1 billion company, and earlier this year it was declared bankruptcy and taken private, and all of that was wiped out. You know, my shares were wiped out, his shares were wiped out, his reputation took a massive hit. You know, and he's starting from scratch. And why is that? Why could someone be such a creative genius, but not be able to manage it, right? That was very, very scary to me. And there, I mean, that's just one of the more public examples. Obviously, yeah. I've seen it with other people that I try not to talk about. But what you see is, when you're around really successful people, especially creative people, you see just how you see they tell you what they want and what they're, you know, in like the general public, you just see like, hey, Kanye has a new album out and it's good or bad, right?
Yeah.
You weren't sitting with him, not that I was, but you weren't sitting with him in the studio where he was telling you what he was trying to accomplish and what his goals are. And you didn't see how his enormous ego and his delusions and his vanity were preventing him from realizing that vision. And so, you know, when you see these successful people who work so hard and have, you know, make so little progress on the thing they're working on, and it's so clear to anyone who's not them what the problem is, that the problem is their ego and their inability to hear and listen to the feedback around them, it's crushing. And you think, I mean, I think how easily that could be me, right? I wonder, you know, am I doing that about things? Are there things that other people can see very clearly in my life, you know, that where I'm getting in my own way, where I'm the impediment to my own advancement? And so the book was largely driven by seeing, you know, when you see someone evaporate $500 million of their own wealth, you sort of go, how does something like this happen? How can I make sure that, you know, whatever scale I exist on, I don't do anything like that?
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. I think it's one of the lessons that I've very much learned in this process of writing a book. Like, I constantly remind myself, don't get too high on your own bullshit. Like, this is a privilege.
Sure. I mean, it's sobering to think, like, how many book deals does we're both at the same imprint, right? Yeah. How many book deals does Penguin Random House or just Penguin Portfolio give out every year? And how many of those books even get made, right? How many of those books deliver on the potential that the editor thought they had? You know, how often does the writer manage to create a career out of doing this? It's you know, an alarmingly small percentage.
Yeah.
And I'm sort of fascinated with why that is. Why does someone who has all the same assets and all the same opportunities that you or I have, what prevents them from realizing that? And so often it's their inability to sort of understand objectively the situation that they're in, right? Mm-hmm. that, hey, you know, you say you're working on this book, but you're not making any progress day to day. Or, hey, you've written this book. You're so obsessed with what you think that you spent a year of your life making this book and you never bothered to think what the readers want, right? Yeah. Or, you know, you made this thing and then you thought you were too good to have to go out and hit the road and sell it to people. These are all reasons that prevent people from being successful. And I think, you know, obviously there's a myriad of causes for them, but they're, I think in large part, they're rooted in ego and hubris. Mm.
This episode, just like every other episode of the podcast that you've heard this year, is sponsored by HostGator. So you've heard a lot of different things from a lot of different people this year about how the nature of work is changing. You heard Chase Jarvis say that the artistic portfolio will become the dominant paradigm for future careers. You've heard me reference things by Seth Godin. So hopefully we've made a convincing case for why you should start a website or some sort of web project where you have a web presence. And sometimes the easiest thing you can do is just buy yourname.com. And that is one of the easiest ways to get started. So I'd recommend if you're not ready to do anything, do at least that. You'll actually be supporting the show in a really big way. All you have to do is go to hostgator.com/creative and register your domain, and you use the promo code creative for 30% off at checkout. Let's talk about the adversity piece a little bit and the role that ego plays in moments of adversity and how we can avoid it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest... The chapter that I was most proud of in this section is this, and I saw you mention it in an article, and I was very flattered by that. It's, you know, you sit down and you work on something, any project. You're starting a company, you know, you design a car, you know, you have a garage sale, right? Like you work on this thing, and then at a certain point, it goes out into the world, and it relies on other people, right? And one of the hardest things to do is to separate your work from and what your effort that you put in from the results that might come out of it. So it's like, think about it. It's like an actor doesn't control the movie around them. They don't control what the other actors do. They don't control the marketing budget. They don't control the distribution. So, you know, they could do the role of a lifetime, but then the director could, or the editor could mess it up in post-production, right? And so if your happiness with your job and your career is dependent on how the movie does at the box office or how the critics respond to your role, you have now placed your happiness with your own life in the hands of other people. And that's a recipe for profound disappointment. Right? Like my last book was much more successful than I expected, but it could have been much less successful. And would that have changed what I made? No. It feels like it does, but it doesn't. So I have to think of that book, ideally, the egoless way to think of that book is to have the same opinion of it now, however many thousands of copies later, that I had with it the day it went to print with the publisher, because that was the day that my role in it creatively ended, right? And that's such a hard thing to do. And even now, on the verge of this other book coming out, I have to remind myself that what I can take pride in, and this is you know, rooted in Stoicism, but that what I can take pride in and what matters is the part of it that I controlled, which is the effort that I put into making it. How many copies it sold or what blogs pick it up or whatever, that's outside of my control. I can do a good interview with you right now, but you can decide. You decide whether it goes up on iTunes or not, right? And so if I make my happiness or my opinion dependent on that thing, then I'm putting you or the outside world in control of my life.
Wow. This has been epic, man. I have to say, like, this is probably my favorite conversation of the three that we've had.
I think you like it because you're wrestling with the same thing. That
Exactly. It very much is, like, it's given me a lot to chew on.
And it's hard because, like, what obviously, as a business person or as a person who hopes to make money from what you're selling,
yeah.
you do care about how it does. And I'm not saying that, you know, I'm some Zen monk, you know, like I've written it off and I'm giving all the money to charity or whatever. Like I'm still going to work hard to promote it, but I have to remember that. I mean, one of the things I was writing in the book that I was thinking about is like, think about like, you know, Martin Luther King was today, everyone thinks Martin Luther King is a hero, right? But 50% of the country thought he was a communist agitator, you know, in the 60s, right? Like clearly a huge portion of society disagreed with Martin Luther King in his own time. So should he have taken their opinions into account? Or did he have to realize that like, hey, I control what I believe in. I control the people that I work with. I control the cause that I dedicate myself to. But I don't control how the outside world interprets what I'm doing. And that ultimately history is going to be the judge of this thing. And, you know, I think that's the same for a book. It's like, think about like some of my favorite books. A book like Moby Dick, you know, Herman Melville died in poverty because the book was not a success. Yeah. And so you've got to realize that, hey, public opinion is not, especially in the short term, is not a great judge of something's quality or not. And so as a creative, you have to be able to render that judgment on your own work. And ideally, it should be based on the effort. You know, it's like, it's not, hey, is this good or not? It's, hey, is this the best that I was capable of doing? And if you can get to that place, and I'm not even at that place, if you can get to that place, the creative life will be a very satisfying one for you. The creative life is based on whether you make a lot of money or other people say that you're good at it, then it really is going to depend on the rather fickle winds of public opinion, whether you're satisfied with what you're doing or not.
Hmm. Well, that makes a fitting end to a conversation. So I want to ask you one last question, which I know you've probably heard me ask before. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
That's a great question. And I think the one thing that an artist is trying to do in their job, in their course of their career is become who they are, right? Austin Kleon, he talks about sort of how you steal like an artist at the beginning of your career. You're just taking all these influences and trying to sort of make something. But as you do this over a longer period of time, you're really trying to become you because you're the only person that can do that. So I think what's unmistakable is when someone is sort of authentically themselves in what they put out there. So they've stopped, I hear from lots of authors or companies or whatever, and they're like, oh, I want to do this because this thing is popular. Or I want to do this because like, you know, it's a good like Google search term or whatever. That's great. But what I always say is like, look, literally anyone could do that. Mm-hmm. What is the thing that only you can do? And if you're doing that, then obviously you're unmistakable because it can't, if only you can do it, it cannot possibly be confused for anyone or anything else. And so that's kind of what I try to think about with my own career and what I try to advise other people is like the closer you can get to expressing the thing that only you can express, the more unmistakable you're going to be. And on top of that, I think the more successful you'll be.
Awesome. Clearly you've read my book. Well, Ryan, this has been phenomenal. I really, really appreciate you taking the time to join us and share your story and your insights. And I can't recommend this new book highly enough to everybody who's listening.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate it. I'm so happy for you. I knew you should write a book, and I'm really glad that you did. And I'm more excited for the one that comes after it because I know you're going to be even better then.
Awesome. Next time on The Unmistakable Creative.
And so I think to me, it's really about first noticing influence. We don't want to admit it happens to us. If you ask people sometimes do see influence. They see other people driving the same cars. They see kids listening to the same music. In fact, if you look around, there's only one place that people never see influence, and that is themselves.
Jonah Berger joins us to talk about the invisible influences that shape our lives.